This episode of the Monocle Weekly was first broadcast on the 11th of October 2015 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to edition 327 of the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24 with me, Robert Bounds, and Tom Edwards.
On the show today, we're celebrating the masters of pop art, and we've not heard of any of them. The World Goes Pop is Tate Modern's attempt to refresh the US-dominated narrative of pop art by focusing on equally great work from Asia, Latin America, Eastern Europe, and more. Flavia Frigeri will be telling us all about it a little later.
Then we'll hear from Mohamed Fahmy, the former Al Jazeera journalist who was jailed in Cairo for over a year, along with colleagues from the news network. He'll be telling his story in one of the first interviews since leaving Egypt.
And we'll be on a boat. British sailor Alex Thompson will be introducing us to his new Hugo Boss vessel and explaining why German industrial designer Konstantin Gürcik has helped make it a place you'd want to spend some time alone in for 25,000 miles.
That's all coming up. Plus, Monocle's Henry Rhys Sheridan will be forecasting the biggest stories of the next 7 days with the news look ahead. And we'll play some great music too, right here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24. Had any nice emails this week?
My inbox is always brimful
of ashes.
I'm sure that's what you mean. Chock full of
everybody
all sorts
needs,
of things.
Exactly.
Invitations,
threats,
compliments, idle threats. It's a real smorgasbord.
Well, I'm pleased
for the connoisseur of the digital realm.
Okay, it's very nice. It's very nice. Do you get the time to switch off? Are you one of those people? Do you fretfully check your emails? I mean, here we are on a Sunday. I hope you haven't. I mean, other than obviously them helping to put the show together and having a look and seeing what all the logistics are. Mm. You're not a Sunday emailer.
I try and switch off for an hour or two. What's interesting, of course, Rob, is that leaves one with a bit of extra time. It'd be interesting to hear from Alex Thompson a little later on spending time alone for, 90 days?
I'm looking forward to speaking to Alex Thompson, the round-the-world yachtsman.
That's a terrifying business.
He's a single-handed sailor, which sounds rude. It's one of my favourite Dire Straits songs. It is. It's from an album called Communicate. It exists.
That's perfectly fair enough. What about next week's news? At the moment, I know nothing. Shall we remedy that situation?
There's something tugging at the end of my line. I've caught myself a Henry Rhys Sheridan. It's the goddamn hoochie coochie man, Henry Rhys Sheridan.
I'm warming to that.
Henry, in your theme tune there, they said, "Love the way you do something, Henry." What did you hear what that was?
I didn't. I wasn't listening to the content of the words particularly closely. I was mostly appreciating the structure this time.
Okay.
Because it strikes me that not only is it thematically relevant insofar as obviously it's explicitly mentioning my name, but it also actually has it kind of crescendos in a way that you would like a theme tune too.
Yeah, I'll go
you
with
know,
that.
And I kind of
like Top Cat.
Precisely. I actually referenced Top Cat when I was offering guidance to Tom when he was
Did you? Yeah,
you
know. I want it to be like you want to be the basically want a hat where your ears stick through the top.
Precisely. I've got very freakishly small ears though. You can't see them because I'm wearing the
Well, you're wearing headphones.
The headphones. I'll show you later.
Close fitting hat maybe.
Yeah, exactly.
So Henry, what is occurring around the world this week? Enlighten us, if you will.
Today, on Sunday the 11th of October, there is a presidential election in Belarus. There's kind of one theme in Belarusian politics, which is Alexander Lukashenko, who is the president and has been since 1994. This will be his fifth election win in a row.
He knows how to fight an election.
He sure does.
In inverted commas. you're not suggesting that it's not all whiter than white, are you, Henry?
Well, there may be kind of shades of cream trickling in there, off-white. But what's interesting is that it's one of these situations where he would almost certainly win, even if it was completely free and fair, which it's not.
So you can't blame him then in that case. He's just cutting to the chase.
Mm. He's just making the process easier. That would result in the same outcome anyway.
Yeah.
His rule is kind of synonymous with the stability provided by Russia's support. And as a consequence, many people, even the middle class in Belarus, are pretty enamoured of him. There's also hardly a viable opposition, and even less so this time round, unfortunately, than last time round. So
it looks like a done thing. So don't be visiting your bookmaker.
Oh, yeah, I think there'd be pretty tight odds, yeah, on it. It would probably be a bit of a waste of time, but anything can happen.
So they definitely vote for Russia in the Eurovision Song Contest.
It'd be interesting to look into that.
Terms that I understand.
To put in terms of, I think it's a pretty consistent Russia vote. Okay. Yeah, Russia were excellent this year. Is always different to gauge in the Eurovision.
They were good, weren't they?
Right.
Yeah,
not in Germany. That was
Russia were excellent all year in Eurovision.
They were.
What else is happening, Henry?
On Tuesday the 13th, it's the Democratic primary debate in Las Vegas, the first one.
Woo!
It's at the Wynn Hotel. I just like the fact that Bernie Sanders is going to be in Las Vegas, hopefully hitting the slots afterwards.
Hitting the slots and then doing some gambling.
Exactly. I'll let that fly. Anderson Cooper is going to be chairing international television superstar Anderson Cooper.
Oh, he's dreadful, isn't he?
Yeah, he is. Yeah. With the excellently named Don Lemon. Helping him, feeding
lemon
questions
or lemon?
In. Lemon.
As in like Keith Lemon?
Citrus, like the citrus fruit. And he's going to be feeding in questions from Facebook.
God.
It's going to be Sanders, it's going to be Clinton.
Do you like my picture of me sitting on a beach drinking a cocktail, things like that, you mean?
Precisely.
Okay.
Which it'll be interesting to see Clinton's position on that particular statement. But there's also going to be three people who we haven't heard of.
Speak for yourself, Henry.
I am speaking for myself. Good. And perhaps Rob too, given the Eurovision reference in the last... Russian politics debate. But there may be Joe Biden as well. We don't know if he's going to enter yet. You can enter as late as the day of the debate, which I find astonishing.
That's pretty
considering
cool.
It is.
Sweep it. I might just do it.
You're going to throw your hat into the ring late on.
But I always think how permanent the lecterns look, you know, when it's kind of broadcast and TV.
That's the magic of television.
Exactly.
Mm. They've got wheels on.
So I've been told.
How do you think they get in there?
There's very low clearance between the ground and the bottom of
they're
the lectern,
like the Easter, they're not like the Easter Island statues. They're not like there. They won't be there this time next year, Henry. They've got wheels on.
Trying to find people to stand behind next
year. Yeah, lecterns in search of hopefuls. You know.
The natives logged all the lecterns in Nevada, and then the civilization disappeared. Yeah. No, it should be interesting. Hillary Clinton's come out against the TPP last week. And she's also
If I'm going to Portugal, I always go BA. But I wouldn't fly on those. Yes.
And she's also going to... she's also plans to kind of hash out a strategy against the excesses of Wall Street, as she put it, a pending. I think she's going to announce that soon. Which is interesting because she's kind of protecting her left flank against Sanders' assault and trying to win back Unite Labour.
It's good.
I think it'll be
shaping
fun.
It's shaping up nicely, isn't it?
I think so, yeah.
If they had lecterns, if they have like naturally occurring lecterns in Belarusia, then you'd have this there. It's not their fault they don't have them. It's just that they're more...
They've been planting lectern seeds.
They just haven't come to fruition.
It's a scarce and natural resource.
Yeah.
Just Lukashenko's throne is the only thing they still...
The lecterns don't take in the arid soil.
No, indeed.
On the Belarusian steppe. And then on Tuesday as well, this should also be interesting, mainly because of Russia's response to it.
We'll be the judge of this.
The Dutch Safety Board is going to publish the official report into the downing of MH17. There's good reason to believe that Russia will be pretty heavily implicated in it, mainly because shrapnel found in the bodies, not to get too gruesome, of some of the victims match Russian-owned missiles straightforwardly. It's difficult to see how much worse it can make Russia's diplomatic relations with the West at the moment, though, given other events.
But they'll give it a bash, probably. This is the sad.
They'll probably have a crack, yeah. I mean, I think that everyone is pretty aware of what is probably going to be said. So it'll just be interesting, you know, to watch the...
Could the Russian response be just to... It should just, like, re-last book's Eurovision entry?
I think...
Just so get some plus points back.
Just bring them back.
Yeah.
And just kind of... I mean, I think that would be deeply inappropriate, but possibly their best option at this stage. So,
I could do some PR there. I'm all right at this.
Finally. Also on Tuesday's a busy day, the Man Booker... winner will be announced. It's the second year since it's been open to non-UK and Commonwealth authors.
Big literary awards. Where do you stand on this, Henry? Good thing, bad thing?
Indifferent? It's interesting that the backlash that came out after they expanded it beyond the Commonwealth to try and make it sexier. Because obviously among British authors, it's a big boon to win the Man Booker Prize. I've forgotten the exact figures, but the kind of difference in sales and publicity and kind of future prospects.
It's It's sizable.
It's super sizable. So it's interesting that they've now expanded it, and if an American wins, it'll certainly be controversial. But I'm ashamed to say I haven't read any of the books in the shortlist.
Well, who is going to win? Do we know?
I don't know who's going to win, actually. Not I that I would what... know.
Shall I read
what's
the names?
On the shortlist? What's
Shall
on
I
there?
Read the names?
Yeah, what have we got on there?
There's The Year of the Runaways by Sunjeev Sahota. There's A Brief History of Seven Killings by Marion James. A Little Life by Hanya Yanagihara. A Spool of Blue Threads by Anne Taylor. Saturn Island by Tom McCarthy. I have read one of his books, but not this one.
And I'm afraid that doesn't count, Henry.
And The Fisherman by Chigozie Abioma. I think the favourite is A Spool of Blue Thread by Anne Taylor, which sounds a little bit boring. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah,
you can say
definitely allowed.
It's not based on any substance whatsoever.
Which kind of confers a weird legitimacy on it, the fact that I'm totally ignorant of the topic.
Absolutely. You might get a call.
A bit of fluff in the corner.
Yeah.
It's better than that, isn't it? Or a bit of cobweb that you missed when you were cleaning the house.
Wool down the back of the cushion.
Yeah.
I would have thought you would be bursting with opinions in this, Rob.
I haven't read any of those books.
Really?
All the books that I like are always overlooked for this prize, which sort of sometimes awards really good books, sometimes awards kind of boring but worthy books. That tends to be the problem with it.
That's a shame. Tom and I are functionally illiterate because we're radio people, so we don't have...
for the second time, I shall say. No, what always gets me about these is the sheer volume of books, the critics and various bigwigs.
Like,
it's hundreds and hundreds of books. Yeah. And I cannot understand how anyone can adequately read those whilst continuing to function.
And you know when you go... they don't read all of them, do we? We've had judges in here before that said, well, you know when something you're sort of 78 pages in and you're hating it, then you just stop reading.
But I'd feel a bit... If I was one of those authors who'd been cast off at that point, I'd feel like... What if it really picks up on page 90?
Yeah, well, it shouldn't. It should be good, shouldn't it, by that point?
But what if you're lulling your reader into a false sense of boredom?
So if it's a 300-page book and it's still crap by page 100, what are you going to do? What do you do? What do you two guys
do? I'd throw it onto an open fire.
Okay.
I struggle to find an open fire nowadays, I'd have to say. All the fireplaces in my house are boarded up and tiled up, and they're all kind of cracking, and there's rats coming out of them.
Oh,
I've just moved into a new place. I probably need to give someone a ring about that.
Okay, we've got a window into a
vision of
window.
I probably provide slightly too much insight there into our personal life. Yeah.
Henry, we can probably help you. I mean,
I'm just resting on my theme song now. Is one of the few things I've got in my life I look forward to.
My money's on a length blue thread. I think that sounds really great.
Yeah. A spool of blue thread. There's a spool. There's even a spool on the front cover, just in case
there is a spool.
Mistake it for a length.
Yeah.
I don't like any of those books. Henry, thank you so much for your second ever and really brilliant and very amusing. Mostly unwittingly so.
Sure. I'm happy to be laughed at rather than with, as long as there's laughter occurring.
Good.
I'm okay.
Thanks, Henry. You're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly. In a moment, we'll be talking about the world's unsung heroes of pop art with Flavia Figeri.
Here at Monocle, we're always trying to cast a more globally minded eye across the world to highlight those stories being missed by the media spotlight's sometimes polarised perspective. The US and the UK have no shortage of stories to tell, but some of them have been told a few times before. And it's that need to refresh perspectives and get a more rounded worldview that has informed The World Goes Pop, a new exhibition at London's Tate Modern Gallery that tells the story of pop art from a global perspective.
Focusing on the same seminal years leading from the 1960s to the present that produced iconic pop works from storied masters such as Warhol and Lichtenstein, the new exhibition is eschewing those icons in favour of looking at Latin America, Asia and Eastern Europe. What was going on there? Why don't Peru's Teresa Berger or the Spanish collective Equipo Crónica get a nod for playing their parts? Curator of International Art at the Tate Modern, Flavia Figeri, joins us to tell us why. Flavia, welcome to the programme.
Thank you.
Is this a challenge, doing a pop art show that is encompassing the rest of the world rather than the kind of, as we mentioned, the Warhols of this world? Are you trying to sort of pop the bubble of people's expectations with a show like this?
That's a very good way of putting it. We are indeed trying to pop people's knowledge of pop, if you can say so.
Yeah.
And it's a challenge, and it has been a challenge, because the works we've brought in are not your familiar pop icons, but are from all over the world, from Teresa Burga, Peruvian, all the way to Russia and Slovakia. But to us, it has been a really amazing and fun challenge. We travel to all these places and we're able to really unearth a story of pop art that was yet to be told and had to be said.
I was going to ask about the idea of pop art. So we're used to Richard Hamilton, Andy Warhol, these artists incorporating kind of, you know, everything from, you know, Brillo boxes and Campbell soup cans. There's so much, a lot of kind of riffing on branding. When you get to Russian art of this period, where there were no brands because it was communist, how do other countries play with the expectations of the commercialism of pop art?
Well, the interesting thing is, as they don't really have a consumer society, they just reflect on different things with pop art. So actually, as you'll see in the show, pop art is very much becomes a language of protest, of subversion, is used to reflect on the state of countries, nations, many of them under dictatorships, like Brazil, for instance, others with strong censorship, like the communist regimes. And so it really shows that pop wasn't just a language about consumption or reflecting on consumption, but was a language that became a sort of motto to address the politics of the days.
So, tell us a little bit then about the curatorial process involved with this then. Was it about, did you set out very determinedly to reveal things maybe to a viewing public who are going to be visiting Tate Modern, who maybe have preconceived ideas about what pop art is or what it could be or what it could contain? Or did you have other narratives actually that were more interesting to you as a curator that you wanted to draw strands together from all of these different works?
I think it was a combination of the two. On the one hand, we felt very confident that most people are very familiar with pop art. Everyone kind of knows who Warhol is. So it felt that was the kind of ground that had been covered extensively before. And on the other hand, we were very keen on unearthing narratives that were there but just hadn't been quite pulled together yet. And one of these is, for instance, women and the role that women played in pop art. Most of our conceptions of pop art are male artists, or even worse, male artists objectifying women. Whereas we were very interested from the get-go to really find and unearth the women who made pop.
And what did you come up with? Because this is the thing, we mentioned an Alan Jones show was on at the Royal Academy just before your show opened at Tate Modern. Are you interested in things like that, having a conversation, shows like that?
Do you mean like...
Well, in terms of, you know, the pop art that, as you say, objectified women and then actually women making some of this stuff. There's quite a lot going on. There's a lot of different things, presumably, pulling it, different forces pulling apart there.
We strayed away from the sort of Alan Jones objectification of women, as you can see in his tables and chairs, which were quite controversial. And we went more towards looking at how women treated and depicted themselves. So it's basically the opposite side of the Alan Jones coin.
Okay.
Well, let me ask you about the title of the show, because it's The World Goes Pop, which obviously, as we've sort of alluded to already, works on a couple of levels. Do you think there's a problem sometimes that we use these global terms for things and loosely bracket things together, and there's maybe a bit of a laziness from some of the kind of lay people who don't really understand, who don't appreciate how much breadth and depth there is around the world, just go, oh yeah, pop art, I know that, it's a global phenomenon, but it was all out of the, you know, the US and out of New York City. Is there a sort of a laziness there? Is it not as simple as being one easy to label global phenomenon?
I think the laziness was stemmed by the fact that the Americans and the British were definitely more powerful in making sure that their pop art was known. And so that's what we come to associate pop with. And the people I've been showing around, the one question that comes up all the time is, oh, so are these artists looking at Andy Warhol? That's kind of the reference point. And I think what the show is trying to do is to really say, actually, no, they had no idea who Andy Warhol was, but made equally valuable pop art, just didn't have the means to show it. So to us, it was also trying to make a point about how something can be truly global and doesn't need to stem from one centre necessarily.
So did you think, it's interesting, we talked about the lack of consumerism maybe that wasn't a driving force in some of these markets. Was there also an absence of that same consumerism actually within the art market at the time? And did that make the end product almost necessarily different?
The market wasn't the one that we know today. And many of these artists made works that weren't sold, weren't shown because deemed too controversial. So in a sense, they were making art for art's sake, which is a very rare nowadays to see people.
And is it a story that some of these pieces then, you know, languished for many years? Was it a bit of an unearthing journey? Or were there always people who were appreciating these things, even if they had been, as you say, just art for art's sake for a time?
In many cases, they languished for many years. In many cases, I had to knock on someone's door and say, I know that 40 years ago you made this series of works, you still have them, and they would be slightly shocked at that. You know, someone from Tate would rock up at their door and be, I'm interested in
and
your
always,
work.
And always interested in sharing the pieces with you, or a bit of a mix?
Everyone
mix
was actually really enthusiastic. And, you know, I think they appreciated that we were trying to do something that was moving beyond the canonical history. So they were very supportive.
Yeah, that's the interesting part of it, presumably, as curator, going and knocking on people's doors. As we said, if you were going to do a show, I mean, there was that great Richard Hamilton show at Tate Modern last year, I guess. We kind of know where the sources, where those works are stored and all the rest of it, presumably some in your own collection there at the museum. But what about for this one? Tell us about that journey of, you said at the beginning, it's pretty fun flying around the world with your fishing rod, trying to find these works. That's the good bit, right?
The journey was amazing, and it's a very rare kind of journey, even for a curator. It's not your kind of standard exhibition, because we started out knowing about a few pop artists, and so we started with the known ones. So we would travel to Brazil, meet the famous ones, but then for them, collectors, museums, curators, we slowly started coming about all the other ones. And so it took us 4 years of literally going from Brazil to Peru to Argentina to France to Spain, Slovakia, Russia, Japan.
Passports gone through the wars then. And in terms of your curatorial notes for this, how didactic you want to be, how kind of robust you want to be, and how much you want to tell people what is going on, and not what they should think, but you might suggest what they might think when they're looking at these.
I think people...
Is that a challenge with it when it's a new set of works that people aren't familiar with like this?
It's one... You touched on one of the biggest challenges, because there's, on the one hand, people want to be guided, but on the other hand, you don't want to impose.
Don't be bossy, Flavia. Exactly.
An explanation. And so it's always a struggle. So what we try to do is provide as much information, contextual information, that kind of makes you understand how a work was made and in which situation. But we don't want to try and say, okay, this is how you need to read it. But it is a show that can be challenging if you don't have some guidance.
And I went to it because you curated the cutout, the Matisse cutout,
yes, show,
which was a huge success. Everyone loved it. And it was kind of art for art's sake. You might say it was beautiful. It was fun. People could get it. Does this follow on from that in some way, that you can be, you don't have to be heavy handed with your curatorial instructions or your notes? You can just show people fantastic things and they can allow them to make up their own minds a bit.
You know, I think Matisse is a very different kind of exhibition. It's colourful, it's something that people know, it's something that children love, it's something that grandmothers love. Pop art is not necessarily the same kind of bag. It's, in many ways, it's slightly more radical, you can say. It's something more different, and it's more challenging for those who go and see it. The moment you step in, you must be ready to leave Warhol outside of the door. In not the way that you are asked to leave Matisse outside of the door when you go and see the cutouts. And so it's kind of asking two different things. And I think as a result, two different kinds of people tend to go to these shows.
Okay, so you're wearing two very different hats as a curator,
yes,
putting on those two.
Yes, they're very different kind of curatorial projects.
Is there anything that a grandmother might like, though, in this?
Oh, she would love it. A grandmother would love it.
So everyone's welcome, you know. Children to silver hairs, everyone will get something out of it.
Absolutely everyone. It's just that they will get it if they engage with it. It's not your...
That takes my grandmother straight out of the equation. She just wouldn't be willing to make the effort.
Well, but she probably... Would she recognise the Vietnam War?
She probably would.
So she would like it. There's lots of things. I mean, the thing with pop art is there's so much about it is recognisable images, that it's easy to engage on that level. It's just not your immediate crowd pleaser. I guess that's the difference.
And Tom asked a question about the art market, and it's Frieze this coming week.
the show will obviously be visited by lots of the collectors, lots of the people that come to London once or twice a year for the fairs and the auctions and all the rest of it. Is this a good opportunity to kind of open up that market as well? I mean, there's obviously lots of things that people scratch their heads and go, "Ah, oh, darling, there's one of those in the attic." I know this happens, but is there anything do you take? I mean, obviously you've got a very different curatorial role at a museum that this very commercial week has, but presumably you'd be interested to see who walks through the doors that week.
I mean, us as a museum, not for profit, we don't engage in the commercial side of things, but I think people will definitely look at this and see some potential in it.
You're going to get some more business cards printed. What? It's good.
It's good for the artists.
It's good for the artists, indeed. And in terms of the era, I mean, some of these artists, I mean, this, I guess there's the hot spot for pop art was 50s, 60s, 70s. A lot of these people still making work, or are there?
They are and they're not. Variable. So some of them just made pop art for 10 years and then one became a customs agent, went on to do completely different things. Others simply became mothers, gave up pop careers. Others are still making pop work. Others went on to make conceptual work. Some make still lives. Some make boxing paintings. So it's a real range of what people went on to do.
I love the idea of the pop artist who became a customs agent.
It's a fantastic...
This story is to be continued.
Flavia, thanks so much for coming to see us here on the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
Time for some new music now. New Zealand musician Kim Flaum was a part of Dream Popper's Yumi Ziuma until late last year. Now she's readying her debut solo EP as Madeira. Here's a new track. It's called Let Me Down.
Caught in the air, never looking at, but you'd be better than that. Watch out, never get your love. Hold your breath, don't bet on it.
That was Let Me Down by New Zealand's Madeira. You're tuned in to the Monocle Weekly on Monocle 24.
The Monocle Minute is a just-launched daily email bulletin covering all the topics we're passionate about, from global affairs to retail news, finance to urbanism, architecture to transport. Packed with opinion and reports from around the globe, it's a unique briefing on the day from our editors and correspondents. Go to monocle.com to sign up for free today, and we'll send you the Monocle Minute to your inbox every weekday and deliver you a special cultural roundup at the weekends too. Monocle, keeping an eye and an ear on the world every day of the week.
You're with the Monocle Weekly here on Monocle 24. Now, on December the 29th, 2013, Egyptian security forces stormed the hotel room of three Al Jazeera journalists and arrested them for reporting false news, which was allegedly damaging to national security. The world's media suddenly took notice, and the 100 or so journalists imprisoned for a range of crimes were in the spotlight. One of those was Mohamed Fahmy, an Al Jazeera TV journalist, half Egyptian, half Canadian, working for the English language arm of the network.
After almost 2 years in prison, Fahmy has now been released, and on his way back to Canada, Fahmy dropped by Midori House earlier this week to tell Steve Bloomfield the story of his ordeal and why he's still fighting for press freedoms around the world.
Mohamed Fahmy, welcome to London.
Thank you for having me. This is my first interview here, so I'm very excited.
Excellent. Well, look, we're delighted to have you here, not just obviously on Monocle 24, but delighted that you have your freedom and that you're on your way home, or at least to one of your homes. We'll come on to that in a moment. First of all, how are you feeling?
I do feel like I'm born again. It was almost 2 years of a very horrific experience. I was sentenced twice in 2 years. First sentence was 7 years, then it was cancelled, and then I got 3 years and finally pardoned. So it was an emotional roller coaster for all of us involved and our families. And finally, I'm home free, and my wife can now relax. She's been my biggest hero throughout this ordeal. And I feel like I have so much I want to do and a whole new life ahead of me. So I'm very excited about this freedom.
Let's go back a few years to when you first became a journalist. In fact, even before then, why did you want to be a journalist?
Well, I honestly loved a challenge as a growing up. And journalism is a real challenge. But I also felt like I wanted to make a difference and make a change. And I was lucky enough to have a global perspective growing up in Kuwait and Egypt and Canada. I was traveling a lot. So I was exposed to a lot of the current affairs and events. And it was just something I really wanted to do. And I started in the Iraq War. I was the first day of the war in 2003 with the Los Angeles Times as an assistant reporter. And that was my schooling, basically. And I spent the whole year in Iraq. And then I went to Dubai Television for 2 years and worked in the Gulf. And then went on with CNN and Al Hora TV. And I covered the Arab Spring. And, my imprisonment was, aside from the personal injury, if I may say that, it was also a dream that has evaporated with lots of the liberties and freedoms we wanted, basically.
Did you feel that your journalism had a purpose over those 10 years or so, that you were covering events that were close to your heart and also covering a region that was going through some enormous changes?
Yes, indeed. It was harder to cover the events in Egypt, for example, because you have to be objective, and at the same time, you're covering the streets where you grew up for part of your life. So it was very tough, and to stay so focused on the job rather than bringing your emotions in. But yes, there are stories I'm very proud of, and I felt that they did make a difference, and the region is now in a very, very complicated situation. The war on terror, the so-called war on terror, is being used immensely to clamp down on civil liberties and press freedoms, and it's becoming very complicated and tough to be a journalist on the ground. You're being targeted by both extremist groups and governments, and there's almost no place for us to work safely. So part of my mission now is to advocate for many of those imprisoned behind bars and to work on some policy changes in terms of protection of journalists. I'm trying to put together with others in Egypt a sort of a charter that we want to submit to the Egyptian president to protect journalists in Egypt specifically. So, there's a lot of good that came out of the experience I've been through now in these 2 years. It's very hard to go through this experience and not be a changed man and not be inspired. And that's what I think I'm going to focus for the next period.
Let's talk about the early days of the Arab Spring in Egypt. Covering that, did you feel that it was as momentous as it certainly appeared to be at the time? Or did you have reservations that it perhaps not as much was changing as perhaps many people hoped?
No, it was real. It was real, and I could see a lot of my friends coming from abroad, from Canada and the States. Egyptians were dual citizens who felt the dream is coming true, and they really wanted it to see it happen. And on the ground, for 3 years covering these streets, yes, there was a chance for change and real improvements. But I guess along on the way, the youth that sparked this movement were not organized enough to handle the stage after the ouster of Mubarak, and the Muslim Brotherhood were the most organized group, and they basically took over the political scene. And from then on, things went a little bit rowdy, if I may say. They were not very inclusive in their approach, and I really hoped that things would change, but I believe that with my imprisonment, it was symbolic enough to send a message that whatever started in Tahrir Square has long evaporated. It's gone, basically.
How difficult was it as a journalist in those days after Mubarak left, when you had the first elements of democracy beginning, opening up again in Egypt, then the Muslim Brotherhood coming in, and then the eventual crackdown? As a journalist being there, what were the particular challenges of covering those events?
Well, the challenges were basically that there was so much confusion on the ground, and the Muslim Brotherhood did not really engage openly and transparently with many of the journalists on the ground. And for me, it was tough to operate in a place that, you've had the police force has been shaken up. The military was still trying to understand how to deal with this group. So there was a lot of confusion, and there was a lot of it was tough to actually figure out who's calling the shots, what is exactly happening. And I believe that all journalists in Egypt at that time had a very hard time operating on the ground. And it got worse as the Muslim Brotherhood were also removed. And I think it's a real, real challenge for journalists to be able to report freely and safely at the moment in Egypt. And there should be a review of how to protect journalists from prosecution on the ground. So that's something I really want to work on.
In the weeks and months leading up to your arrest, did you sense that the space you had to act as a journalist was being constricted?
I knew that Al Jazeera's Arabic channels were under the microscope. That's why when I took the Al Jazeera English job as bureau chief, I made it very clear to my network to separate me from Al Jazeera Mubasher in Arabic, and that we do our own independent news gathering, reporting, sourcing. The network agreed, but they breached their agreement, basically, by taking some of my content, rebroadcasting it into Arabic on the Arabic channels and dubbing it. And that put us in a very tough situation because the Al Jazeera Mubasher, the Arabic arm focused on Egypt, was shut down by a court order just days before I started the job. And the court order said that they're biased to the Muslim Brotherhood and they are a threat to national security. Now, if you're Al Jazeera or Qatar and you don't agree with that, that's fine. But in Egypt, that was the law then. So using my content on the Arabic channel put me and my team on the radar, for one. Two, Al Jazeera English did not have the proper broadcast license. It was revoked, and when we asked, me and my team, they said that everything was in place, focus on your editorial side, and that's what I did. But apparently we found out in court that they didn't have the right broadcast license, and that made our situation much worse. It gave the prosecution more ammunition, and it put us in a tough situation throughout this ordeal, this unjust ordeal. And you know, I believe that the network could have done things in a much, much better way.
During your time in jail with Bahar Mohamed and Peter Greste, there were, as we've just said, big campaigns around the world for your release. And in Australia, the Australian government had a very high-profile campaign. You heard then Prime Minister Tony Abbott would talk about it. Julie Bishop, the foreign minister, would talk about it a lot and say how unacceptable it was and would try and do what they could, it seemed, to put pressure on the Egyptian government. Do you feel you had the same level of support from the Canadian government?
There is no comparison between the support Australia gave to my dear colleague Peter and what Canada did for me. Mr. Tony Abbott, the Prime Minister, for example, spoke to President Sisi three times during our incarceration, while Mr. Harper didn't. And this mild approach was brought to my attention when I was released on bail by many critics across the world. And then I realized that we need to engage the Canadian government more. And they responded constructively. But I do hope, and I'm planning to start a debate back in Canada about what could be done to learn from this trial and to better protect Canadian citizens abroad. Because I know tomorrow morning, other Canadian innocent citizens could be in a similar situation like mine with all the politics and the turmoil in the Middle East. So this is something that's very, very important for me.
Do you feel your government let you down?
Yes, I do. I do believe that the government let me down. But I do thank, and I always do thank, the consular team on the ground in Egypt because they were visiting me, they were protecting me, they wanted to do more. But again, the policymakers in Ottawa need to understand that when your citizen is caught up in a situation as complicated as mine, the most senior level of officials in Canada should intervene immediately, because if there's anything that could be done to save the situation, it would be done before the case is referred to court, when you're still at the prosecution level, at the police station. And that's something that's very, very important. And it could be a life or death even situation, because, you know, such intervention could even just get you transferred to a better prison, get you out of the terrorism wing where I was for 1 month in solitary confinement. So yes, there so much needs to be done in terms of protecting Canadian citizens abroad.
You're about to take a flight back to Canada. Where do you think your life goes from now? What is it that you still want to do?
I want to do a lot of what I'm doing right now. Speak about freedom of expression, protection of journalists, changing of policy to protect others who fell in my same trap. But I also just want to, you know, my wife, she's never seen Canada or snow, and I want her to see Canada from my, you know, I want to see Canada.
Is she going to be happy with snow?
She will be. I mean, she needs a break from what happened. I mean, Vancouver, where I'm going, is more rain than snow. But I've also started the Fahmy Foundation in Vancouver with my lawyers, and it's an NGO, nonprofit organization, and we are advocating for Jason Rezaian, who's in Iran, the American journalist Raif Badawi, who's in Saudi Arabia for his expressing his thoughts. He has 1,000 lashes and 10 years in prison. Mahmoud Chauka, an Egyptian journalist, photojournalist, who's been in prison for 2 years for doing nothing. And again, others like Atina, she's an Iranian cartoonist in prison for cartoons. And Tay, he's an Ethiopian journalist, again, who's in prison for politics and bogus terrorism charges. He's a great editor, and I believe that raising awareness is important. Also, I'm advocating for the Qatari poet Muhammad Al-Ajmi, who's in serving 15 years in prison for one verse in a poem. And I'm so angry that he's in prison, because if you read this poem on the internet, it's such a beautiful poem. So yeah, these are people I'll be advocating for, because just it's all about raising awareness that could make a huge difference. But I'm also in contact with their lawyers, their families, and in some cases, entities from their government back home where they are imprisoned.
That was Mohamed Fahmy talking to Steve Bloomfield. And you can hear a longer version of that chat on the Foreign Desk, now available to listen to at monocle.com or as a podcast, of course, through iTunes and all our regular channels. This is the Monocle Weekly. We're going boating, Rob, right after this.
The Arctic is one of the more inhospitable places on Earth, but as Monocle's film crew discovered, there's a trove of stories to be told by the local media about the vast and varied Canadian Arctic.
You start looking at residential school relocation, you start looking at missing and murdered Indigenous women, you start looking at food security and the incredibly high suicide rate here in Nunavut. If we wanted to, as a network, just stick to those stories, we could be the saddest show on Canadian television. You have to balance some of that out with some uplifting stories to show people struggling against those conditions, but winning.
Reporting the Arctic, now showing, along with over 500 more Monocle films and slideshows on monocle.com.
Now, a race in which 50% of the competitors don't actually manage to finish might sound somewhat inglorious, but it's the old adage. It's not the winning, it's the taking part that really applies here. The Vendée Globe non-stop round-the-world race is an endeavour taken every 4 years by yachtsmen completely solo. British sailor Alex Thompson has competed 4 times, and next year will spend the 25,000 miles on the waves sailing aboard his new £3.5 million Hugo Boss boat, designed by VPLP and fitted out by the superstar German industrial designer Konstantin Gercek.
It's quite a meeting of talents. Thompson is the youngest skipper to have ever won a round-the-world race and also the fastest Brit to ever sail solo around the world. Gercek's work, meanwhile, is more likely seen in the form of very attractive chairs and furniture heralded in museums such as the MoMA in New York. At the end of this month, Thompson will be taking the new boat for a spin in the transatlantic Trans-Jacques Vabre race from Le Havre in France to Itiai in Brazil, a 5,000-mile test of its capabilities. But he's found time to speak to us before he goes on the line from Gosport near Portsmouth here in the UK. Alex, welcome to the Monocle Weekly. First of all, this is I love the idea of taking this boat for a spin in a 5,000-mile test drive. Is this really kind of when you know whether you and the boat can be buddies enough to do the round the world trip?
Yeah, I mean, even more important, finding out whether we're buddies for the round the world race, we find out whether she's fast or slow. So it's the first time that we put this boat up against another boat of its type.
Well, Alex, tell us a bit about that then, because I guess people will think, look, you can design these things. We know the incredible expertise that goes in and your own feedback and input as well. Is it not possible to know one way or the other? Or is it only ever once you're actually in the water that you can really, really see how the boat feels?
Yeah, I mean, the designers of VPLP and Verdier, they can simulate on their computers, you know, what performance a boat should have. But it's not as simple as, for instance, a car racing around the track. When a car races around the track, you know, obviously if it rains, there's a variable. But generally, if it's dry, you've got, you know, the track and the rubber. Whereas for us, you know, we're working underwater and out of the water and where the two meet. So it's very difficult to simulate it accurately, particularly now as our boats have what we call foils, so essentially wings that go out the side of the boat and lift the boat out of the water.
I mean, we mentioned this TJV race, Alex, this Trans-Jacques Vabre race from France to Brazil. Is that kind of a recognised warm-up for around the world? Does that have some of the same weather conditions, water conditions, and some of the stuff you're gonna come up against in the real thing?
Yeah, absolutely. The Trans-Jacques Vabre is a race that happens every 2 years. It starts in Le Havre every time and finishes either in the Caribbean, Central America, or South America. In this case, it's Itajaí, just south of Rio. So essentially, it's the first 5,500 miles of the Vendée Globe, which will happen next year. So absolutely same conditions. We've got 20 of the competitors of the next Vendée Globe. You know, all the big teams, all the established teams, all the superstars. So it's absolutely the time for us to be able to see whether our boat performs against them, you know, in terms of speed, and also how she performs from a reliability point of view. As you said earlier, 50% of the people who start the Vendée Globe don't finish. So we have to make the boat fast enough, but we have to finish. To finish first you have to finish.
Absolutely, it's a good mantra. Alex, let me ask you a little bit then about the boat. We've already talked a bit about the relationship you have with it. And I know you've spoken before about when you've lost boats and this feeling of sort of sadness that you had, that you lost a friend almost. Is that necessarily the way it has to be when you're undertaking what could be such a potentially lonely enterprise as something like a round the world attempt?
Yeah, I think it does. You know, the around the world in 80 days, you're on your own and your boat is your best friend. It's the thing that's going to keep you safe. And my objective is to look after her, and hopefully she'll look after me. In the lead up now, so our boat's been in build for a year, in design for 2 years. You know, now I'm just starting to get to know her, know what buttons to push, what not to push. And over time, you know, our relationship will grow, and hopefully I'm going to love her and she's going to love me.
And down at the boatyard itself, Alex, I mean, how hands-on can you be? Is this the point when they're sort of finishing the fit out of the boat that you kind of become involved, not exactly in the fixtures and fittings, but then you can kind of see the thing coming alive rather than it just being a drawing on a drawing board? At what point do you kind of get, does your input start to really flourish?
Well, my input starts right from the very beginning in choosing the designers for the boat and what kind of philosophy we want to go for, how it works. You know, the entire working part of the boat, the ergonomics of the cockpit, the interior, everything is designed about my weight, my height, my strength, what I like, what I don't like. And now, yeah, we are now in the finishing touches. So we've essentially done our sea trials. And now we're into where does the pocket that's going to keep the tea and coffee going to live, and you know, the kind of details that just make life on board easier. You know, when you're out there on the ocean on your own, essentially doing 10 people's jobs in one person, having to move an extra couple of centimetres to get something is a waste of energy. So we try and make everything as perfect as possible, and we're trying to finalise that in the next few days before we go over to the start.
Alex, let me ask you about that you just mentioned. You're saying making your job easier. I guess everything's relative. It is one of those extraordinary undertakings. And I don't know, to a slight sort of layman like myself, one of the questions I always want to ask someone who's, you know, a practiced sailor at undertaking these sorts of enterprises is why you do it. You're probably bored of getting the question, but it sounds so lonely. It's so demanding. It's so dangerous. What is it about it? Is it the old, you know, the lure of the ocean, those old sort of poetic notions? What makes you do it?
Well, before, I guess the lure of the ocean for me, one of the things I love about it is it doesn't matter how big your boat is, whether it's a tiny little dinghy or, you know, a reasonable sized yacht like I have, or even a cruise liner, when you go out to sea and you get past the point of being able to see land, you understand how small you are as a human being. And that gives you perspective. And I find that humbling. You know, the key things for this kind of thing are, firstly, the challenge. You know, to my mind, the Vendée Globe is the single most difficult sporting challenge that's left in the world today. So it's a true test of a person's physical and mental being. It's mentally very, very tough. And so, you know, I'm attracted to the challenge. And when you put it in perspective, I think there's less than 100 people have ever done this, whereas there's more than 3,000 people been up Everest. So the challenge is one thing. The second thing is I'm a competitive person. So when I play squash or tennis, I'm the guy that leaves the court with cuts and bruises because I cannot bear to let the ball go down. So to be in a race that's going for 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for 12 weeks, that's right up my street. And then the last thing is, you know, these boats, if I think, you know, lots more people are into cars than they are boats, or are related to cars. If you're into cars and you secure a deal to be able to go and build your perfect racing machine, you know, the ultimate Mercedes, whatever, and every year you get to spend more money in making it quicker and making it more perfect and suited to your needs. You know, if you were into cars, would that not be the perfect job? So they're the three main things, I think, that why I do it.
And you mentioned that less than 100 people have finished this race. This is your fourth attempt, right? And the last three times that hasn't worked out. What are the kind of perilous parts of the race which you dread? Or what are some of the ways that competitors commonly bow out of this particular race, Alex?
Yeah, well, this will be my fourth Vendée Globe, so you're right. And the first two Vendée Globes I didn't finish. The third one I finished in third place in 80 days. And this one we're aiming for a win. In terms of perilous, you know, the hardest part, the worrying part, the bit where you feel the most isolated is when you turn left at Africa and before you turn left at America. So going around Antarctica and down there in the Southern Ocean, the waves start in South America and they're able to go around the planet unimpeded, so they get bigger and bigger and bigger until they get to South America. And the same with the winds. You know, the winds come across the Atlantic here to England, to Britain, to Europe. And we in Britain and Ireland take the brunt of it. And by the time it gets to Europe, it's normally dissipated a little bit. So land generally will calm the depressions, the lows down. Whereas down there, there isn't any land to stop it. So it's big winds, it's isolated. If something happens, there are no rescue services, you know.
And is this where you've kind of come a cropper before? I mean, is it the wind and the waves in those areas that's caused you damage before?
It's not necessarily caused by the wind and the waves. But yes, I've definitely come a cropper. Halfway between Africa and Antarctica in 2006, the keel on my boat broke and I ended up having to abandon the boat into a life raft. And I was rescued by one of my competitors, a chap called Mike Golding, who lives down the road in Wasatch. And he essentially saved my life.
Wow. That's like getting a tow from a neighbour in yes. Portsmouth, right?
Well, I wanted to ask you as well, I think you definitely win the award for understatement. I like when you just sort of said, yeah, you know, left Africa, left America. I mean, do you find that you need to, whilst on this challenge, you need to break it down into almost like small manageable component parts like that? Because is the enormity of what you're doing a bit, I don't know, could it be a bit overwhelming? Is that one of the devices you use as a solo sailor?
Definitely the first time I did it, I found it very daunting, yeah. Very, just the sheer thought of having to spend 90 or 100 days at sea on my own. When all the boats had left at the start, you know, I really didn't know what to do. It was very tough. I don't really break it down too much anymore. I just tell myself that it's going to be a slog. It's going to be hard. It's going to be tough. It's not going to be enjoyable. And I just need to retain my focus and get on with it and not whinge or moan about it. And I feel that if I kind of approach it that way, any little glimmer of niceness or any bonus, then it's doable. For me... All my emotion revolves around whether I'm doing badly or doing well. You know, if you have a great Vendée Globe, like I did last time, finished third, then, and I, you know, either perform to expectation or overperform, then best race in the world. If you're performing below expectations, it is hell on earth.
What about the mental preparation for it? Is there a space in which you have to kind of find yourself at that starting line and then halfway through the race? Or do you just take it each day as it comes sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, I think mentally is the hard thing, and you have to be naturally mentally tough from the outset, really. But I work with a sports psychologist, and the way I work with him is I explain to him some of the challenges I have. So, for instance, when I'm deep in the Southern Ocean and I'm surfing down 50, 60-foot waves at 20, 30, 40 knots, and I have to go down below and sleep for 20 minutes, 30 minutes... When you go down below, your brain is screaming at you that you're going to die. So I explained this kind of problem to my sports psychologist, and he helps me develop a technique to deal with it. So the technique in this case is that when I'm inside the boat, rather than thinking quite insular about it, I imagine that I'm actually outside the boat, not at deck level, not at mast level, but up kind of towards the clouds. And I can look down at the boat and I can see, yeah, it's pretty hairy, the boat's going fast. I can see there's no icebergs ahead, I can see there's no shipping ahead, there's no whales, and the waves don't look too bad. And that just allows me to lower my heart rate, reduce the amount of adrenaline that's flowing from my body, and get some sleep. But that's something that we spend months and months and months training for.
Wow, it certainly sounds pretty... I don't know, I'm not sure I'm made of that stern stuff that you were describing a minute ago, to be honest, Alex. I think I'm too cowardly. It sounds like an incredible undertaking. So let me ask you this finally. When you, if you're successful, and we wish you, of course, all the best, when will we hear from you? Do you sort of patch in reports from the boat? Are you completely on your own? Or do we need to wait until you've finished it before we get to hear how it's been?
No, you know, nowadays, thanks to the internet, the internet lends itself perfectly to what I do. So you can follow every day now. I tweet directly from the boat 3, 4, 10 times a day, whatever's going on. Facebook, Alex Thompson Racing, you can follow it there, and from the website you can get on the tracker and follow the race minute by minute. So it's very easy now. I'm sure you'll be able to beam in the next few years and watch what's going on directly.
Thank you very much, Alex Thompson, and bon voyage. And that is it for edition 327 of the Monocle Weekly. Tom Edwards, what a classic it was.
That was a classic edition. I feel we were on the high seas. We heard incredible stories of resilience and human dignity in the face of challenge. We heard from Henry Rhys Sheridan as well. I don't know what links those two
together. Yeah, Alex Thompson, do you think... we speak to people, we spoke to him on down the line, and we wondered at the beginning of the show whether he was going to be worried by a lack of nautical expertise and our kind of lack of sort of our non-salty dog tendencies.
Yeah.
Do you think we convinced him on the telephone that actually we kind of know our stuff?
I think he thinks we're a couple of jolly Jack Tars.
Okay, that's quite a dated... I like that.
Why not?
No, I like it.
I like to roll out some of those sort of Victorian era expressions now and again.
Pugwash.
Why not?
Shall we thank our team behind the glass? Today's show was produced by Tom Hall. Our studio managers were Claire Urban and Chris Grimes. The Monocle Weekly will be back at the same time next week. For the time being, from me, Robert Bound.
And from me, Tom Edwards.
Thanks for tuning in.